The first night we hung out after I went and saw him the record, I think it was like that night, we got all fucked up and we were listening. He was like, he was turning me on to B-Fart shit, and I'd known B-Fart, but he really turned me on to like Doc at the Radar Station. And I was like, and so we're in the middle of this, and I go, hey man, all right, listen, I probably should get going. What are you up to tomorrow? And he's like, I got to take a final in geology. And I was just like, what? Like, and he wound up flunking out of school. Because I was just like, you're taking a final? You know, like everybody else was freaking out and studying. And he was so not into geology.
Magical revisionist history, yeah.
Hello, I'm Matt Sweeney, and this is the Matador Revisionist History Podcast. Today, we're joined by the great Michael Gibbons of the great Bardo Pond, and friend of Bardo Pond and founder of Carbon Records, Joe Tunis. Bardo Pond is releasing a couple of crucial reissues to their 90s catalog, and oh my God, what a catalog it is. Seriously. Set and setting for the album's 25th anniversary and a double LP of rarities titled Melt Away. Both of these are in stores and on streaming services today. Go check them and have your mind melted. This chat was really exciting because Bardo Pond is one of the most special sounding bands that I've ever heard. They sound like they're playing music for the first time, and at the same time they sound exactly like they know what they're doing. And it's so, you know, the magical and earthy and stunning. And I was lucky enough as a youngster to I think maybe take them on one of their first tours outside of Philly with my band Chavez. Check this out. If you just want to hear the coolest origin story of a band and why a band does what they do and how a band came to get their sound, it's in here on Matador Revisionist History, Bardo Pond, Michael Gibbons episode. Check it. When did Bardo Pond take off and start going over to Europe and stuff? Because again, like we were all playing like pretty early on, as far as you guys being an active band, right?
We, you know, it was a while. We didn't go over there till, you know, I think like 2000. You know,
really?
Like, you know, well, like 2001, summer, like after. I remember like after 9/11, like we went started going to Europe more often. You know, we didn't go that much like the first few records.
Who were you playing with, and how did it like? How did it vibe?
You know, we were like playing. It was cool. We were playing. Who did we play with in those early days? A lot of places. You know, we were the headliner, so you know, it was a lot of local dudes that we played with. We didn't tour like with anybody. You know, later we played with Mogwai when we went over there.
Okay, all right. Okay,
so it was a lot of fun, and yeah, like,
was there any freaky skull flowery connects or anything like that?
There was, like, I think the dudes from Viber Cathedral Orchestra, we played with a gig, you know, like in Leeds. We played with the guys from not Viber Cathedral, but we played with the guys from it. That was really cool. Yeah, we played with a lot of really cool bands, a lot of strange, like more experimental rock bands,
right?
I love Skullflower. We never played with them. I would have loved to play with them. We played with them in a festival once.
You put me onto them, I remember, back in the day.
Oh, cool.
I was like, this is fucked.
It's fucked up. It's so good, yeah.
Yeah, so good.
They do so many different things. I was just listening to them, actually, the other day. Yeah, it's like, I think the worker's called Transformer or something. It's I love that. Dude, that guy's a freaky cool dude.
Joe, how did you vector with Bardo Pond?
Oof. Bought a 7-inch from Parasol. Remember Parasol, that mail order out of
the
Chicago area? They'd send you a trifold, you know, stapled in the mail every 2 weeks with like 3-point font. And I like read this thing. I'm like, oh, Bardo Pond, that sounds pretty good. Got that. Yeah, it was on what? Compulsive? The Dragonfly 7-inch?
Yes, yes.
Right? I think so. And yeah, blew me away. I always describe that's Dragonfly in particular, but like Joe's drumming would make me feel drunk.
Yeah.
Or high, and I don't smoke. And it would make me feel like kind of out of it.
Yeah.
It would like warble the way he
just,
you know, his drumming just kind of, I don't know. It's like Weird Pulse or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I got into that, then picked up, what was after that? Like Big Laughing Jim and Buffalo Various and stuff. And then you guys came up here.
Mm-hmm.
Lapsed might have been the first one.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Joe was still in the band.
I think we played Amanita. We played when Amanita played.
Oh, it was Amanita
there too. Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember playing some Amanita songs up there. There's one great video, the YouTube video of us playing like Yellow Turban at the Bug Jar. What was that place called?
Yeah, the Bug Jar.
Bug Jar.
Oh, it's probably my video. Yeah.
I'm looking for that tape.
Can't find that tape.
Yeah. And it was that, so that was like after Amanita. So we did play, we went up there and played there like pretty early on. I'd love to go up there, man. That is a great town.
I remember those, both those shows, like after the second show, you were just like, this is the fucking best room. It's a really small
room. It's so great. Yes.
I went up to Toronto. You guys are doing that tour at Mogwai.
Oh,
yeah. I saw you there at some big joint and it was annoying because everyone was talking during your set. and then I happened to be in Austin, Texas on a road trip with my partner and you guys are playing there and I walked up to you and you're like, what the fuck are you doing here? it was like out of nowhere. I think you play with like ST37 maybe or something. It was like
we always play
psych
with
them bands. Yeah.
Yeah. I got out of school. I was at the Art Institute of Chicago for studying painting.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I was like, John and I started jamming when we were little kids. Like, we would always be playing like bongos and just doing stuff and fucking around singing. We never knew how to play guitar or actually play anything, but we would always record weird shit, like experimental funny shit. Yeah, so in Ocean City, New Jersey. You know, we were born in Philadelphia. We're both born in Philly, and then my parents moved down to Ocean City, New Jersey.
So, did you go to Luigi's a lot?
Luigi's, yeah. We went to Luigi's.
Mac I used to go Mac there every goes. Summer, yeah.
John and I still did that. So what happened was I was in the Art Institute of Chicago, and I started, and Clint and I had met before I went to school out there. Right when I got out of high school, I moved to California to get residency and go to school out there and try to, you know, just have my college paid for out there. And I met Clint when I was living in Morning Glory. And he was like he was coming up to get this Lester Bowie record at this record store I was working at. It was a record that I kind of wanted to steal from the stash, you know, of the store. But I never got around to putting that away. I had so many other ones that I was trying to buy, and he came up with it. I couldn't believe somebody came up to the desk with that record, and I told Clint, I was like, oh, sorry, that record wasn't really supposed to be out there, and it's not for sale. He just looked at me like, what? And I said, yeah, and I was like, I'm just kidding, man, you can get it. But wow, I can't believe somebody's buying this record. I've been waiting to get that one. And we wound up hitting it off, and we went to see a lot of shit. We went to see like Ronald Shannon Jackson and all this stuff out there. We went to see, me and Clint saw Minuteman open up for Jamal and Dean Takuma at like what was that cafe, that L.A. Club Lingerie or some weird fucking club, like,
what, you saw Minute? What was like, you saw Minuteman?
Minuteman, yes, before Big Boone died. He died like a few months later. I mean, that's it was sick. And so Clint and I met there, and we went to see shows. And then I wound up leaving California and went to the Art Institute of Chicago. I transferred, and I never had played music, but this girl, I was living in her house with her family. This guy was a writer for the Chicago Tribune, and he let me live in the basement. But his daughter was living upstairs. I don't know. He was a really nice guy. But I wound up jamming with her brother, and he would play regular guitar. And I was really into noise music and no wave at the time, you know? So like Ardo Lindsay, I was just like, I don't need to know how to fucking do this. Just give me an amplifier, and you know? And I started doing that, and meanwhile, this kid was, you know, he tried to play. He didn't know what the hell I was doing because he didn't have any idea, you know. But we had fun, you know, and we would just do that. And So after I wound up hanging with her brother all the time, and then after I got out of school there, we broke up, you know what I mean? But I've had this bug of playing, you know, music, you know, seriously, because that was like all I did. You know, I got fell in love with that more than this painting shit I was going through at school.
And it's that's like, when it happened. That's when it happened.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. And so when her and I broke up and I got graduated from school, I was just like, do I go back to California? Because I did love Clint a lot. And I just met him, and he was actually trying to get his art career together. I met Clint after we did that thing, and I wouldn't sell a record to him. We went all these shows. The first night we hung out after I wouldn't sell him the record, I think it was like that night, we got all fucked up, and we were listening. He was turning me on to Beefheart shit, and I'd known Beefheart, but he really turned me on to like Doc at the Radar Station. And I was like, and so we're in the middle of this, and I go, hey man, all right, listen, I probably should get going. What do you up to tomorrow? And he's like I gotta take a final in geology. And I was just like, what? Like, and he wound up flunking out of school because I was just like, you're taking a final, you know, like everybody else was freaking out and studying, and he was so not into geology. So he wound up going, like, he was inspired by me trying to be an artist, so he was like, fucking, I'm, and he flunked out, but USP felt so highly of him. They were like, listen, you just take a break, you know what I mean, and figure out what you want to do. Because they didn't want to kick him out, because basically he flunked out, but he was such a, you know, he's a good, you know, smart dude, obviously. So they knew he just wasn't into it, but I'll never forget that. I wouldn't sell him the record, and that later that night, we're getting fucked up listening to Beefheart, and he's like, yeah, I got a final tomorrow. I was just like, dude. So anyway, I did want to go back to California. I wound up coming back. I moved back here. My brother was going to art school. I talked him into going to art school. He was going to art school in Philly. And I came, basically, I was like, I'm coming back to Philly. I stayed in Ocean City for like 6 months, and then I moved to Philly. He was up here. And I was like, I remember talking. I was like, John, I'm playing guitar with this kid. It's so much fun. I'm coming back to Philly. Let's get some guitars and just start fucking around. And actually, I got a bass. I was like, I'm gonna get a bass, you get a guitar. So I did that. I came back here, we moved into this apartment in Philly, and we just started jamming, you know, like, but we didn't know how to tune, we didn't know how to do anything. We were just completely just doing this anti-music thing.
So cool.
And dedicated, that's all we did. We were having so much fun doing it. I told Clint, he was like getting out of USB, and he was like, I gotta apply to school. So I was like, you know, hey, John, I'm in Philly with my brother, and we're doing this music thing. And Clint and I got together because of music. He was like, you're kidding me. You know, he's like, so he was like, all right, I want to try to come out east, you know, and go to school. So meanwhile, John and I are playing. We wound up talking. He was going to the Academy of Fine Arts. And we got, you know, of course, there were guys there who could play. And one, a drummer and his friend was crazy dude, was a guitar player. And he would come over, and me and my brother and these guys would just be doing noise. And this was like months and months. We were just getting together once or twice a week, you know, doing this, like having a ball. And the one kid that he played, he actually was kind of like that girl's brother that I was going out with Chicago. He knew how to play, and he would have fun watching us just like going off, you know. But he finally grabbed me one time and was just like, dude, you should just learn how to play. You guys are doing this so much. And he talked me into learning how to play a few chords, bar chords, and tune the guitars. And I talked Clint and John into it. Clint and me, you know, he wound up getting to go to school at Rutgers in Jersey, and he would come down every weekend, every other weekend, and play with us, you know. And this,
I love the idea that you had to talk your bandmates into tuning the into tuning the guitars and playing chords.
When this guy told me to do it, I was like, no way, man. We are, we're not going to sell.
No sellout.
Yeah. I'll never forget it. He talked me into it. He was like, it's just going to take 5 minutes. Let me just show you this. You know what I mean? And he just showed me how to tune and play a chord. And I was like, fuck. And I just took to it. You know what I mean? I was like,
you liked it. Yeah. That's how did it feel? That's what I was going to say. What did that feel like?
We had been playing, basically learning ways to play in a key together, even though none of us knew how to tune or anything. So we would just do these repetitive Can was our hero in Velvets, but it was like Velvets were almost too musical. Can was more like this kind of noise. But it was like we were drones, you know, we're basically doing. You know, we had our distortion pedals, but we... we had the shittiest equipment. It was hilarious, but like we were just going off. We loved it. We did it for, you know, people would actually come over to watch us, you know, do what we were doing. This kid taught me how to play, and I loved it. And I, after I was resisted, but it was so funny when I told Clint and John, like, "Come on, you guys, let me just show you how to do this." They were horrified. They were so fun. I'll never forget it. They were thought I was such a dick. I was like, "No, come on." And dude, after we, showed them, and me, this guy Brian was helping do it, we had tunes like almost instantly. We were making up songs. Oh. Like it was just like, we went from being complete noise improv sound thing to having like E, you know, E, A, C, D songs, you know, like, it was wild. It was wild. We just took to it. We took to it fast. It wasn't like we had that intimidating learning how to play guitar thing. We could see and how the tunings, how we were, the way we were already fucking around anyway. And it just was like not intimidating. And we all just like, it was like we were instantly playing songs. It was crazy.
I think, you know, part of the freshness of the sound, I mean, is because it sounds like people doing it for the first time. There's no, it's utterly cliche free, you know, and with tons of intention.
It's exactly right on. It's exactly right on. Because when I, after we were doing that for, after like 6 months and we had these songs, I was like, fuck, I'm going to send these, a tape out to some places, like, you know, Khyber Pass, you know, and it was like I was just they were just like, no, I don't know, and I was like, yeah, I think we're doing some good stuff, I'm gonna do it. And I sent like tapes, I sent it one to the Khyber, I sent one to the Knitting Factory, because like a Knitting Factory, you know, it's the original place where, and it was like, it was so weird. Like I called the Khyber a couple weeks later, and I was just like, hey, I sent a tape in, my band, you know, I was just wondering if anybody listened to it. And the guy at the Khyber was just like, I think it was Dave Frank, and he was just like, listen, okay, appreciate you sent tape in, you want to play, but listen, if we like your tape, you know, we'll let you know, you know, we'll give you a call back and let you know, okay? And I was like, oh shit, I'm sorry. And I was like, but I had already said Bardo Pond. He was like, all right, well, what's the name of the band? And I was like, Bardo Pond. And he's like, okay, Bardo Pond. Yeah, well, you know, we'll check, look around for it. And I was like, oh, wait, hold on. And like somebody behind him was like, what'd they say? You know, and I could see, and he like, heard a muffled thing. And he's like, he gets back on. He's like, you know what? We did get your tape and we actually liked your tape, you know? And he was like, we want you to play a show. And I was like, oh my God, really? Yeah, thanks, man. That's cool. I'm glad. And he's like, so cool. Yeah, we want you to guys to open up for Smog and Royal Trucks.
Fuck.
Yeah. I was just like, dude, those were like Smog, and I just was loving Smog's first record.
Yeah, it's so
and
good,
Royal
yeah.
Trucks was like the god, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like Twin Infinitives was just like all we listened
god.
To.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it was just like, I'll never forget it, you know? And then when I told Clint and John, they were just like, what? And so suddenly we, you know, went from just, we were opening up for those guys, man. It was crazy.
Did you have a drummer at this point?
So, at that point, it was wild. So the guy, when Brian showed us how to play, we were playing for a little while. And then Joe kind of showed up in the middle, of like at the end of that period, right when we started making, Joe was a huge part of why like the songs came together so fast. Because the dude that was playing with us when we were just a noise freak out outfit, he kind of quit, and he was our first drummer to quit on us. And I put a flyer in the record store here, Third Street Jazz, and it just like listed, you know, like half Japanese, Dead Sea, you know, all these weird fucking bands. And Joe was the only guy that responded to the ad, the flyer I put up in the record store, man.
I'd love to see that flyer, half Japanese in the Dead Sea. That's like,
it was like, it was like 10 bands that were just so weird. And, and so Joe came in and actually, he had a brilliant way of like sharpening the tune. Like we would be like, here's this tune. And he, it was sick. It was like suddenly we were bad. That's the tape I sent out to the Khyber and shit. It was like when he first started with us.
Mm.
Yeah. It was wild. It was wild juxtaposition when we were just kind of playing noise once a week or twice a week to Joe coming in and actually making songs up.
What years is this? Sorry.
This was like 91, you know, 91. And then because the first show at the Cobb was 92. And yeah, so it was like, you know, 89, 90, we were just playing like straight noise, improv and noise. And then that Brian talked us into playing it. So for like 6 months, we started actually playing songs. And that's when, then Bob quit. We made our first 7-inch that came out on Compulsive. Brian Dilworth put it out. And that was with the first drummer. That's the only recorded thing with that first drummer. And then Joe came in, and we made up a lot more songs. And I sent the tape to the Knitting Factory and to the Khyber, and Khyber came. And then the Knitting Factory, dude, few weeks later, they called me, and they the Defunct was playing a big weekend. Defunct, remember that band Defunct?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
They were wild, nowhere.
They were like such a thing.
Yeah. They were a thing, you know. It was like Joe Bowie, Lester Bowie's brother, and they were the last no wave kind of big thing. And they canceled this big blowout weekend they had, and so they let these two intern guys. One was Tom Windisch, you know Tom Windisch. The guy, booking agent too, like
yeah,
the giant
booking
big
agent.
Time.
Yeah.
He does Ass and Mothers. Him and this other girl, they gave them the weekend, and they had listened to our tape, and they put together the show. We played a gig.
Oh, shit.
They got us a gig. It was us, Low, when they first came out. So we played with Low, and it was you remember that band Bitch Magnet? That Jonathan or whatever that guy's name was.
He had a new thing,
and we played with his band. And
Vineland.
Yes, exactly, yeah. Vineland, yeah. And it was wild. So we got the show at the Knitting Factory, and
that's when it was on Houston. That was when it was on Houston.
Yes, the Houston one. Yeah,
dude, I saw Sonny Chirac there.
Sick.
Yeah, dude, insane. Like, I guess I was in college. It was like 88 or something like that.
I never saw Sonny, man. I wanted to see like Last Exit, you know, or anything with Sonny would have been insane.
There's a video of the show that I saw.
Oh, cool.
Actually. Yeah.
Is it Sonny's band? Sonny Chirac band?
Yeah, like, yeah, it's sick. And it's like two camera. It looks really good. If you look up Sonny Chirac,
I can't wait. I'll check it out.
It pops up. Yeah.
Yeah, I haven't seen that.
Fucking.
Shit.
It freaked me out. It was awesome.
I always loved that he did the tune like for, you know, Space Ghost Coast to Coast. Like, that's the Sonny Chirac. That intro, the song that intros that show every time is Sonny Chirac.
I don't know how those guys.
Yes.
Whoa. That's right. Oh, my God.
Yeah, it's Sonny Chirac.
That's fucked. In short order, so your dreams come true right away.
Right away.
Yeah.
It was weird. It was like, and then, you know, we were so happy to get on records like with Drunken Fish. And like, it was like immediately, as soon as we got the gigs and the shows, that same jam tape I sent to the Your Flesh magazine, was like, you know Your Flesh? You know that dude? It's such a great, those guys, Mike Trushan did a review of our cassette, that first cassette. Actually, the first cassette I ever sent out was just to them, and they are the only people that reviewed that thing. I did send a cassette out to a couple, mostly because that magazine I like, that zine. And those guys reviewed it. So from there, Brian here already liked this, and he compulsive put our first record out. But the guy who read our review in that magazine, Darren from Drunken Fish, he wanted to put an album out. So suddenly, like, dudes wanted to put out 7-inches an album.
So we were
playing the Khyber, and you know what I mean? Within like a year.
Crazy.
It was wild. And then within that next year was like Darren put the record out, Brian put the record out, and then Gerard would call me once in a while. Gerard would call me to ask us if we wanted to play a show somewhere, you know? And it was like, I forget the first one was like, Oh, the guy from Homestead Records. You remember Homestead Records?
Yeah, of course. That was Gerard's label, but then
Gerard's label. After Gerard left Homestead, and went to
Steve,
Ken? I think his name was, or something. But like they had a show, and Gerard got us on the show, and I remember him, the guy from who was like all Homestead guys, and then he went to, Gerard got us on that show, and it was like William Hooker was there. It was really cool, like William
crazy.
Hooker, and we played that. Then Gerard called us, and we played another show, and then after that he was like, hey, we're thinking of asking you guys to be on Matador. I think we opened up for 33 or something.
How did the 10-inch with Mogwai happen?
Well, Mogwai was, you know, we were tight. Mogwai loved us, and we loved those guys. They liked us. As soon as they got on Matador, they got in touch with us, and we did that tour together. And then they asked, that was their idea, like, hey, let's do it, you know, for the tour, set 10-inch, you know, split 10-inch record.
Was there any conceptual jibber jabber between the two guys?
No, there wasn't. No, we just, like, they just said, you do your side, we'll do our side. I think we got influenced by a little. That one tune that we put on that thing, I think, is kind of a Mogwai-ish kind of tune.
Did that come out before or after that tour you did? Was it after?
I think it was during the tour.
It was during the tour? Yeah.
Yeah, it was for the tour. We sold it on
those guys came up and recorded at Dave Friedman's, you know, out in Fredonia. Yeah. And, one afternoon, the Bug Jar owners, Bob Duke, I don't know if you remember him, Big Bob, he calls us. He's like, hey, you guys want to open up for Mogwai like tomorrow night? What are you talking about? He's like, yeah, they just need a break from recording and they want to come out and play the Bug Jar.
That's so cool.
They came out and they had like five full stacks in that room.
Yeah. In that room. It was insane. Holy shit.
Yeah.
That's so
And
gnarly.
Like, you know, a lot of people in town didn't know who they were, even though they were on all these magazines at the time. But our town, you know, obsessed with.
So was that Hilke that played with them?
Yeah, Hilke, yeah, oh, we cool. opened up for them. Yeah, yeah. But, yeah, super loud. Yeah, crazy. They were a lot of fun, though. But
I just saw Stuart this summer.
Oh, man, I love that guy.
Yeah, man, he's great. He's so chill. It's interesting when you know somebody for a really long time and you knew them when I mean, he was so fucking young, right? He was like...
So young. So young.
He's so chill. And he's so it's fun. He's exactly the same except for that he's really chill.
Those guys, they really. It was so much fun. We toured with them like all in Europe, and we did a big tour in the U.S. with them.
That's so cool. That must have been more stuff. That's sick. I didn't know that.
We had so much fun. Yeah, like
so that was like big venues and shit.
Yes. And, awesome. And, you know, it was like, I don't know, we were always kind of like, when we came out, man, like, we didn't really get to play that many shows opening up for big acts. Like, we kind of did a lot of shows, like, we were right away headliner. We didn't get to, like, play, and we always wanted to do that, like, with Pavement or Sonic Youth or something. Sonic Youth asked us later on, too, but, like, so we just kind of didn't get that, like, you know, an introduction to, like, bigger rooms by opening up for some bands. It was like, we did some in Philadelphia, but we never got really asked to go do some shows like that and tour with a band that was, you know, and make the $500 or whatever a night open for these huge shows, you know. But those guys hooked us up, like, you know, and asked us almost like every tour they were trying to do if we could do it, and we would do it if we could, and if we couldn't.
That's so cool.
And, yeah, like Stuart and Dom. I love Dom.
Barry.
Too, man. Like, and Barry. I love Barry. Yes. So much fun. That was like touring with you guys, you know what I mean? It was just like the best dudes, you know.
How did you guys hook up with Isabel? Like, when did that happen?
Isabel was one of the people that was at John's school that would come over and jam with us when we just, like, you know, like doing these crazy jams. You know, we had a big living room, and some of those guys would come over, and she was somebody who came over, and I think she just started. Like, she just started playing with us, you know. We were just like, you know, especially when we started to learn how to play tunes, she just kind of was like coming in. She would do background vocals on, like, and like Clint was singing at the very beginning, and then Isabel would do some background vocals, and then she wound up doing a lot of vocals. And when she, once she said she knew how to play the flute, it was just like, yeah, let's give that a try. Like that, and that really just made our whole identity, really. It was just like,
for sure,
when
right.
she started doing it, you know? It was like, I'll never forget that. That was like, she was so amazing anyway. And then she was like, oh, I play the flute. And we said, yeah, let's give that a try. And I'll never forget the first jam was just like, oh my God. This is insane, you know. It was just so it was so out of left field, you know. Like we never even, you know. And she was so she's such a good improviser, and like she's had like such a great feel. She just fit right in, even though we were playing like this wild, you know, loud shit. And she just Clint wound up bailing on us. He right when shit was really starting to happen out of nowhere, he decided that he wanted to move to Seattle. And I'm like, dude, I'll never forget. I'm like, I had to drop him off of the train. I'm like, you're moving to Seattle with this chick that you just met. And he's just like, yeah. And I'm like, and he was like, well, what do you want to do, man? Like go on tour and stuff? And I was like,
yes.
I was like, yeah. We've been doing this for 2 years, dude. What are you talking about? I mean, it's happening. And he bailed. And so that was like Isabel had been doing, and was like, Isabel, would you like to be our singer? We're going to keep going. Clint's leaving.
That's so
and
funny.
She was like, yeah, sure, I'll give it a shot. You know, it was like, it was a godsend, really, you know? And I, yeah. And because I was playing bass, and I just was like, as soon as he, at John and I were making up a lot of the songs, I was playing guitar with him. And even, and then I would kind of go to my bass after, like, we'd make up the song. I'd show Clint, like, we'd show Clint the chords and stuff. And, as soon as he quit, I was just like, I'm playing guitar. And we had seen Trucks. When we opened for Trucks that night, they didn't have a bass player, and it was just the drummer and Nick and Jennifer. And it was like no bass, and they just sounded fucking insane. I was like, we don't need a bass. So like, John, we're just playing guitars. And so we did that for a while. And Joe was the drummer. It was like, it was insane. It was insane.
And then Clint comes back.
Clint came back, and every time I talked to him, this was like, so he left, this is when the album things happened. I was like, he left, and then I was like, I remember I talked to him like 1 month, we talked to each other like once a month, you know, he's like, he's out there, and he couldn't find a fucking job. It was like, there were no jobs out there, like, he had to work in a photo fucking, he was so miserable, and it was, so, every, but he, meanwhile, I'm like, yeah, oh, yeah, yeah, so we're doing the 7-inch, and this, yeah, he left. He was not even on the first 7-inch. He's not on the second one. And, you know, every time I talk, I was like, yeah, we're doing 7-inches. And then it was like a month later. Yeah, you know, this guy's did a 7-inch. They want to do an album. We're doing an album with these guys. He was just like, and I think the third time when I told him we had another album, he was like, God, it's not working out here, guys. I really want to come back. But it took him like another 6 months to actually come back. And it was just so funny. And it was, I was like, all right, come on back. And I was like, I'm not playing guitar. I mean, I'm playing guitar. You're playing bass. That's how we wound up playing bass. He was a, dude, he's a great guitar player. He should be
I
playing bet. Guitar.
I mean, he's you know, his feel is insane. I could totally
it's
imagine
insane.
Being
exactly.
incredible on guitar.
And he yeah. was, when it was John and him playing guitar and playing, I love playing bass, you know what I mean? Because those two
yeah, me
just
too.
Sounded fucking insane. You know, it was like, right. I didn't need to play. I basically, and I just stole from both of those guys when I wound up finally just being playing guitar. But it was like, he came back in, he was like, all right, I'll play fucking bass, you know? But it was like, it was like, we both, dude, I want to say, when we, it was just me and Joe and John and Isabel, we were like a song factory, man. It was
damn.
Just like, oh my God, we had such a feel together, and we could just throw anything. Like the whole Bouffant Various, like Clint's not on it. That's just me, Joe, John, you know.
That's the record that was my way in. Yeah, yeah.
Yes. Yeah, that's just yeah. no bass. That's just like us. And Clint's on Amen, the last tune. When he came back before
the
reissue came out with the CD, well, not the reissue, but a CD version, he came on it and got on that last tune, a 20-minute. Amen song, but the original LP is just no bass, you know. And I swear it was wild. It was like me and John and Joe could just like fucking make up tunes, like instantly making tunes. Like we had so much to show Clint when he finally came back and you know joined us. It was like kind of like you know, oh shit, now we got to show this dude like all these tunes. And he was learning the bass, kind of. He was more of a guitar guy, and he hadn't played for the whole year he was in Seattle.
But I love his bass play. I mean, again, his style was also similarly, you know, just like doing everything for the first time exactly right, you know, like.
He was a better bass player than I was. You know what I mean?
He's so ill. I mean, he made such. Did he have a specific bass? Why don't I remember?
He got that SG bass, you know, SG early bass. On. Right. He played right, it right. for before that. He was playing a Dan Electro bass.
Did he have a Longhorn bass or something like that?
He was playing that on that tour. He had that for a little while. And then he's still playing a Dan Electro bass too.
Is he?
Sick. He's still got that. Yeah, I know he's still got it.
Yeah, I think so. Have you seen the Bitter Wish or Double
I have
Wig
not seen Bitter stuff? Wish yet. I keep fucking missing him. Is he playing a Dan Electro with that?
I'm pretty sure it's a Dan Electro, and he plays this like weird mini orange stack. It's like a mini stack. Loud as shit.
He gets
just incredible sounds out of that.
Whatever pedals.
Like everyone just stands there going, what the hell is he doing? Like
he doesn't need anything
else. It's confounding. Yeah.
The thing with him, he's so good. Like, I swear, when he would sing, he was insane. Like, he's a great singer, too. You know, like, you never can really hear him. But even just, like, when he's got, like, not that much volume, he's a very good singer. And, like, when he left us, it broke our fucking hearts. Like, luckily, Isabel was in the wings at the same time, because otherwise we were devastated, you know what I mean? Like, because he was, like, the whole vision was him being the singer, you know, guitar player. And, it was insane that we were so proud, actually, that we could keep going. You know what I mean? After he was like,
It's cool that you kept on having all of these like total like huge upheavals. You know, like unrolling with it. And of course, it makes sense because where you came from in the first place with the approach and stuff.
Yes.
So that you could keep rolling with it. You know,
we were ready for it. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And when it finally did gel, when Amanita, you know, was him on bass, you know, and it was just insane, you know, like when he finally gelled with the bass and we had the new, I was a guitar. Thanks, man.
I was rocking the shit out of that last night. It sounded really good. Actually, I just pulled it up online and they fucking remaster or whatever. It sounded pretty goddamn great, I gotta say. Real good depth.
Thanks,
you
man.
Know, like,
that one was recorded in that studio with Jason Cox, and it's a motherfucker. You know what I mean? It's like definitely our biggest, wildest sound. And he did great on Lapsed, too. Lapsed was like the recording of Lapsed. But I mean, I like all the other stuff, too. But like, we were, you know, that was like Amanita's like half, like, in 1-inch tape. We did a, like, that was 1-inch tape. Like, yeah. And Lapse was 1/2-inch tape, and then like everything else, I think like Set and Setting is ADAT. You know, I bought the ADATs, so we were just recording everything and had ADATs. And I always liked the ADAT sound, but I mean, it's not like 1-inch tape, you know, like analog tape. How'd you guys record the Hard Quartet?
We just went into the box, you know, with just computer. I don't think we had any.
You guys should fuck around with some tape, because I it sounds great. I love the sound of the record.
There's some tape, but not a lot. Like Daniel Schlett, who's really cool, who's the engineer that I always work with and brought to make that record. You know, he cooks some stuff on a little tape reel. He'll do that thing.
Yep.
And maybe we had. I'll let you know. I'll let you know.
Okay.
But largely it was standard, you know, modern style, but you know, live. And again, this guy Daniel is like a Rudy Van Gelder freak, and so he's like,
oh cool,
he's really, really good with making a room sound sick, you know.
Nice.
But that's super, this guy Daniel Schlett, that was his that's his touch. But and then he
nice
kind of
job.
Normally his thing is that he has an interesting vocal chain that he does. Like he really like kind of does, he's really good at making a voice jump out of the speakers and stuff. And then that approach got extremely tweaked by Emmett Kelly, because Emmett's he's from a whole crazier sound school and stuff like that. So we mixed it, me and Emmett sort of sat there for the mix, and Emmett really did lots of cool scooping and stuff with the
yeah, you can, yeah, it's so beautiful. Yeah,
yeah, thanks.
It's really, really cool. I don't know what the reaction has been, but it's just like, holy shit, it's really, yeah, like, I needed that.
thank you so much. You know, there hasn't. We're just seriously like one of the first friends who I've gotten to talk to about it. Really, like, so it's just starting to, because I think it comes out this week and stuff. So that, awesome. That's fucking amazing. I'm blown away. Thank you.
I love Steve and I love Pavement, man. But like hearing him with you guys doing that is a whole new level of phase or what, you know. It's just so heavy and like it's so pop but like so heavy. I love it, man. It's just like
I'm so psyched. I'm so psyched because transferring into Bardopon, it's when Chris mentioned the idea of doing that show, I thought it was such an astute idea just because of the way that your drums work. You know, and it also occurred to me that, like, what an impact I think you guys had on all of us in Chavez from playing shows with you and stuff. This,
that was
like,
fun, that tour, yeah.
That was sick.
You guys had a great, you guys had a big influence on us too, man. Absolutely.
Oh, that's cool, man. Thanks.
Oh my God, yeah. We gotta tighten up our shit, man. This is sonic. We gotta it was jarring. We were like, yeah. And I think, it's funny. It's funny you say that. Thank you. That's so
funny. Yeah. And it was cool because I remember at the time, you know, because it's like we had a sound that I think, you know, there are bands I think that had similar sonics to us and stuff and maybe similar approaches to guitars. And I don't think any of the bands were particularly listening to each other, but I was aware. And then I was so drawn to like your guys' sound, which I I think that we had a lot in common, but I think maybe on the surface, maybe other people wouldn't think so, or maybe because of aesthetics, or I don't know what. But like, the drum vibe, what the fuck, dude? It's so sick.
Joe was amazing to play with. I mean, I loved Ed too after him and Jason after him, but like Joe was a wild dude to play with. He really was. He has a singular way of playing. It's like, just like I could throw any, I always had like the weird like kind of tunes, the weird juxtapositions I would throw at these guys, and he was like, of all the guys I ever threw any kind of weird timings with, he always was like game. He would just go oh, okay, yeah, and then he would just do it, and I'd be like, holy shit, like he just, you know, I like everybody else after that, there would be a certain tune I would try to play with them, and they just couldn't get the way I would do whatever it was I do, you know
the
what I mean? It was
just
but Joe was so loose and tight at the same time. He could just figure out. He would tell me what the signature or what I was doing or whatever the timing was, and I would be like, oh yeah, okay. You know, I had no idea what he was talking about, but he would just suddenly play it perfectly with me, and it was like I never had that again, man. I never had that like again. I mean, I had guys do a lot of great stuff, but like he was
amazing.
Did
he have a background in jazz or something or?
Because
I always describe him as playing loose and sort of behind people. Like, he kind of played a little behind, right? And it felt loose, but he totally knew what he was doing.
But then he had these stagger snare things, you know?
Totally.
Like, and it was so cool. And actually, it's the only other drummer that I could think of who is in this, and they're both on their own planets, but I feel like these guys rhyme with each other a little bit as Jim White, you know what I mean? The way that,
yes,
you know, it's the same thing where he just makes it so much, it's
absolutely
really unique, you know, and holds it and stuff. And so I was thinking about you guys when we started doing the band and stuff, because I was
that's
just
cool.
Like,
yeah, thanks, man. That's, I'll tell Joe that. That's fucking amazing. Yeah, that is really cool.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you're right. Jim White is a good, it's another guy.
Do you know what I mean? Where all of a sudden every second matters in this different way, you know?
Exactly,
I mean?
He's always got a, he was so wild, and his timing is weird, because like I would think, you know, you'd be like one, you know, hit like on the beat, but he would kind of do this loopy loop kind of thing, you know, and then meet me later right at the perfect time with this, like, you know, hit. Really cool dude. Yeah,
it also drove too. I just also like that there's a momentum to it, just like a motherfucker,
totally,
you know.
He did it all. It was amazing. I loved playing. I fucking broke my heart when he was like, he had to go, you know. He had the fucking family, sorry for my French, and I love his family, his kids, but like he had his kids, and it was like he had to pursue his, you know, he was a PhD with his chemistry, you know, chemical engineering. I mean, I'd be in the car, we'd be driving to the next gig, and I would just look over, and he'd be sitting in the passenger seat, and he'd be like, he have this fucking formula that was like 4 pages long, you know, and he was just doing this formula. And I would look over like, what? Oh, my God, man, that's insane. Are you doing that right now? And he would be just, you know, with all this shit from a... And he was our drummer, you know. It was just like, holy shit.
But then again, so you know, Chavez and Bardupon went on tour, and our drummer is the same deal. He's this raging genius. Did you know this about James Lowe? Like, so James Lowe.
Oh, right,
like,
yeah, James, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you know, so same deal. Like, James Lowe, like, helps design, like, stents and like hardware systems, computer hardware and computer systems for, like, Merrill Lynch. Like, always different things. Like, he's like a high-level
tech
problem
solver.
That. Yeah,
I remember
man.
You saying that about him back then, but I forgot that he was another science.
Yes,
guy.
No, dude, like who are just like an absolutely advanced human, like you're like, yeah, well, yeah. Some people are smarter, more talented, and just like live are better at life than other people. You know, it's like James Lowe is one of those dudes, like just
How's
so
he doing,
advanced.
Man, is he playing the Skins still?
He's not. He ain't playing. He's so funny, dude. The reason that Chavez stopped was because he's like, I just don't want to do it. You know, like
fuck,
like,
he was so insane.
I know, and he's like it's just too much. It's so much work, and he's like, and in order to do it the way that I want to do it, I gotta fucking work so hard, or else it's miserable. I have to do it this way, and he was like, it's not fucking worth it. He's like, I don't have enough time for it. Isn't that wild? Yeah, yeah, and like we had so many, you know, we begged him, we wanted to do another record and all this shit, and he was just like, no. You know, and then it was for years this ongoing. We'd get back to we'd convince him, beg him, like, dude, we could play like this huge, you know, bunch of huge festivals. We'll come home with like money in our pockets. He's like, okay, you know. And then he'd be like, but that's it. And then at the end, we'd be like, so you want to do more? He's like, no, I said no, I don't. Yeah, like, and he finally finished. He's like, look, I love hanging out with you guys. I'd much rather have a drink with you guys than play with you guys. I mean, like, or just hang out. Like,
oh my god. Yeah.
I know. Is that gnarly?
Jesus.
I know.
And you guys, you were just like, I never thought of even, you couldn't really get another drummer. It's just like, no way.
No, you can't do it. Yeah. No. Not with that band. You really couldn't.
No.
You know
what
I mean? He's part of the thing.
When Joe had to split, man, I mean, I was like, we had to keep going. But it was like, I almost was like, yeah, fuck it. That's over, you know, but. It's just so funny. I mean, Set and Setting was a good example when we played that. What that record was the record that Joe bailed on us, had to bail on us.
Right, right.
Joe couldn't play one night. We were at the Khyber Pass playing a gig, and at the last second, he canceled. Like, he couldn't play. And we didn't know this until we, like, loaded all our stuff in, and he's like, I'm not going to be there. So Ed Farnsworth was the barback, you know, at the Khyber, and it was like, he heard us, we're talking about it, and he's like, hey, man, I'll sit in with you guys, you know? And it was like, all right, I just was like, yeah, we're going to play this riff, and you just, you know, I'll tell you what, just come in whenever. And he came in, it was so different than Joe. It was like, he just came in very strong and, like, you know, hammering this, you know, it wasn't like, he didn't slide in into the
club. No, bam.
And it was kind of like refreshing in a way. And so when finally quit, we were like, Ed, how about you just be our drummer? Because we were, you know, he was the only other guy we played with. So, and he sounded, we had fun that night, so... Yeah.
Michael, did you know Ed already, like, as a drummer, and was he doing
We knew him from playing shows at the Khyber, really. He was like a bartender barback guy at, you know, that we always say, hey, what's going on, and he'd help us kind of, you know, help us load in and stuff. And I knew he was a drummer in a couple of bands in the city. I hadn't really seen many of them. I mean, at this point, that was like when we just started out, and we were kind of like at home playing. We would go to shows, but we were almost like, just kind of getting into the Philadelphia scene. I had just moved here for like a year or so, and John and I were we were just playing and stuff. We would go out and see a few bands that we knew in the city, but we were both kind of new to Philly, so we didn't really, you know Ed that well. You know, we barely knew him. And but he was there that night, and it was like Kelsey. He was like, "I'll sit in." And I forget. I guess the Kyber had a back, you know, a drum set there, and so he. Yeah, because we didn't have Joe's drum, so he must have just like got it, you know, got the drum set that they had, the extra drum set at the club, and just play. You know, he played it. It like saved us. It was pretty wild. It was pretty wild. You know what I mean? We pulled it off. We played basically our tunes. I mean, at that point, our tunes were kind of like one riff over and over, so it wasn't like he had to, you know, do any kind of fancy stuff. But it was just like he, you know, he just pulled it off. You know, it was like, all right. Then when Joe after that, Joe ironically got less and less available, you know, and finally was just like, you know, I can't do this anymore. And then we were like, hey, well, what about that guy we played with, that, you know, that Wild Night at the Kyber, and he came in, and it was great.
Did Ed create a different template for how your songs would go?
He was like, he did, because he just kind of, he was more motoric, you know what I mean? He had a more kind of motoric sound. Like, Joe was flow, you know? He would...
Yeah, yeah.
He could change a fucking riff, you know what I mean? Like, he could come in and play the riff and just suddenly do that thing you were talking about with the snare and just, like, completely
recontextualize
double tempo it or something, yeah, and recontextualize the riff. And it would just send us into this, like... it was so much part of what we did, because we would do that with, you know, distortion pedals and you know, and just like adding distortion levels and levels of volume. He would just like change the way he played and just double time it, whereas a lot of guys just kind of play the same kind of through whatever you're doing with your guitars, you know what I mean?
Right.
He would really react and see and kind of anticipate where we were going. And it was wild with Joe. You know, he would change tunes, you know what I mean, in a way that other drummers are great, but like they don't actually literally physically affect how you're, you know, thinking about a song in a way.
Totally.
You know? Joe,
totally.
He would do that. So, but Ed was just so solid. It was kind of fun in a way to just kind of get more minimal and just like, you know, feel the grooves in that way without having like almost like a rock jazz flourishes, you know, like I'm a sucker for fusion shit, so like it was like Joe's ability to do that was so wild. But Ed was definitely a rock drummer, so when he came in, the tunes kind of got more rock. You know what I mean? We went heavier kind of rock way, you know, because it was just flowed that way, and it was kind
right.
We were into it, you know.
And then when it was were Jason and Ed in together for a second, or how
no,
did the Jason thing?
Ed broke our hearts again, you know, years later. And, you know, it was just like, he was like, I forget why he wanted to. I think it was a lot being in Bardo Pond, man. It was kind of like, finally, it was just like,
I can't deal.
And then there was a guy, Michael Zanghi, who wound up playing drums with Kurt Avile and the Violators on the first couple records. And he was drumming with us. And we love that guy. We actually had a Volume 9. It came out on Fire Records last year. And it's that guy, the period that we played with him. It's pretty cool. It's like, I'll have to get one to you. I'll get one to you.
Yeah, yeah. Love
and,
that.
And you too, Joe. I don't know if you heard that stuff.
I got it.
Yeah, cool.
I always say that I have three favorite bands: Bardo Pond, The Dead Sea, and Lauren Connors.
Amazing.
And then when I talk about Bardo Pond, I'm always getting shit wrong too. like I'll forget that there's records without Clint. I didn't know Clint played guitar first, and you played bass.
Yeah, he was my guitar hero, man.
And then like certain records, especially when the reissues started coming out.
Besides my bro,
of course I buy them, even though I have the original. I'll realize, oh shit, there was like there was a drummer crossover. Like I always thought there were like these very distinct switches between Joe and Ed and Jason. And then when I look at the liner notes, I'm really lazy at looking at liner notes now. Like when I was a kid, I would like, of course, scour them because I had like 10 records. But now it's like, I can't read
you
it.
You got a
I
lot
can't
of records back there, yes.
The Bardo section is like that.
That's so
it's
sick.
It's over here somewhere, right there.
Thanks, man.
Amazing.
Dead
wow.
Over here.
Heavy.
But it's always fun, like, when Setting came out, it's like the reissue, and I'm like actually looking at the liner notes again. I'm like, oh, shit, they both play on this.
Yeah, that's a wild record. It's got two different guys on it.
Yep.
Yeah. Great to see you, man. It's good to see you guys.
Dude. Made my day. I've been looking forward to this. You know, so fucking stoked. And say what up to John and to Isabel, please.
I will.
Yeah, yeah.